The following is presented by Le Sommet Coors Light, celebrity guests, entertainment, and oh, a bit of sports. Every Wednesday night on RDS.
TheOldOrchard.com.
Hedman just makes communication with a stick, and he gave the beaver tap, and Kucherov heard it as he was coming down the slot. Spectacular play, but you see how efficient Kucherov is after scoring his goal. He wants the puck on a stick, and he's dancing right now.
The beaver tap. Pierre McGuire, how you doing?
Excellent, Mitch. How are you?
I'm fine. Pierre's in Washington. He did not have to travel all the way back across America, although I'm sure you'll be watching when things go down in Vegas.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I've been in touch with Kenny Albert today, who's broadcasting that game with Brian Boucher and Joe Micheletti for our network. And then we have our game four tomorrow on Friday morning. I'll be heading down to Tampa real early, and I'll be talking to you from Tampa on Friday afternoon.
How quickly was it apparent, I should say, that we were going to see more of the real Tampa Bay Lightning last night?
Probably after the first 10 minutes. They were solid, but I thought Washington had a very good start. You know, the big story, obviously, was Andre Vasilevsky, who hadn't been very good in the series to date, but he was very good last night in game number three. But I thought after the 10-minute mark, they were solid, really solid. You could just sense that there was a control on their bench. And I made the point to Eddie earlier in the broadcast, you know, Stamkos scored in the empty net in game three, and that really took a lot of pressure off of him. And you could see after Kucherov scored his power play goal in the second period that he was just taking his game to another level. He wanted the puck. It really took a lot of pressure off of him and the team.
And we did, unlike the first two games, see some pushback from them.
Oh, and you're going to see continually more. John Cooper, Rick Bowness, and Todd Richards, the coaching staff, along with Franz Jean, who does the goalies, those guys deserve some credit. They tweaked their lineup a little bit. You know, they took JT Miller away from Stamkos and Kucherov and put Andre Palat up there to create more room, more of that physical play that you just alluded to, and it really worked. It was very, very solid. But I think the one thing that will be undersold, because they didn't get any points, but, man, they made a difference. Cedric Paquette, Chris Kunitz, and Ryan Callahan, Mitch, that line really was effective again last night for Tampa.
I like seeing the older guys at this time of year bring it.
Me too. I really do.
And because you know how much younger the league is getting. It's rarer and rarer to see a guy pushing 40 like Kunitz who can still take care of himself on the ice.
Well, he just understands how to play. He's another one of those guys where the analytics people wouldn't like him at all. But you have to give him the eye test because he knows how to play. You know, he's not the fastest guy. He's not the biggest guy. He's not the strongest guy. But he understands how to play. He understands how to create room. He understands how to forecheck. He understands how to angle. He understands how to go to the net. He understands how to make smart plays with his body. You know, he's fearless, so there's lots of things to like about his game. But I interviewed him before the game, and virtually, and Doc alluded to it during our show, virtually everything he told me in the interview happened in the game. You know, it was pretty amazing. He was Nostradamus before the game.
The success, and I've got Tampa on the brain because we saw it last night, Pierre, but their power play has been so lethal, but it's been other teams too. You look at who's alive in the playoffs. Washington about 30%, Tampa about 30%, the Jets about 30%. Is this kind of a byproduct of the increased power plays we saw during the regular season, which is just leading to sharper play now?
That's a good point. And the other thing is the skill level of players in the league is much higher, and it continues to grow. And coaching is better. Power play coaching is better. It used to be a distinct advantage to the penalty-killing team, especially as a playoff series went along, because people would figure out your rhythm and what you were trying to accomplish. But now it's just the skill level and the adaptability of all these power plays has made it so dangerous to take a penalty in a game. So, Rod, your point is really well taken. And the truth is that the top teams that are still playing, their power plays have been pretty darn effective.
And Boston, before they were eliminated by Tampa, had one of the better power plays going.
So did Pittsburgh.
Right. So isn't that a clear window for everybody whose job it is to improve their team to take a note or two from?
Well, I would say this to you, Mitch, and we did this a lot when I was in Pittsburgh or when I was in Hartford or when I was in Ottawa. If you're not scouting these games, as an organization and you're not studying trends and you're not studying players, then you're not getting better. Because these are the teams you got to catch up to. And you have to see what they are doing. So, again, you and Rod have made tremendously strong points. But it's the truth. And you need to be studying tactics. You need to be studying players' character. I won't say the player, but I remember a year or two ago there was a player signed. And I said to you on the show, did anybody not watch him play in the playoffs? He can't play anymore. And that's where you start to scratch your head and say, man, I don't understand what some of these teams do. I really don't understand. But, yeah, you can grow your brand significantly if you study some of the things that are going on right now.
So, Pierre, in the third period, there was a bit of a push from Washington. And on the left side, Ovechkin gets the puck. He stops it. He takes a slap shot. And he goes bonkers after going back to the bench. And I saw you there, but we didn't have your feed. I'm dying to know what was going on with Ovechkin.
He was really upset at the penalty call. There was a penalty call for a high stick. Actually, at that play in particular, was not even a high stick. It was a cross check to Kuznetsov, and he was furious at the official. And he was like, let them play hockey. This is hockey. So he was very, very upset at that.
Man, between Ovechkin and Kuznetsov, they had 21 shots on goal.
You can't fault those guys for anything. You know, anybody that tells me that Alexander Ovechkin doesn't care or Kuznetsov doesn't care, they don't know these guys, and they don't see them on an everyday basis, or they're just so biased they can't see. They refuse to see. He is laying it out there. Every single shift he goes out, he's trying his tail off. Evgeny Kuznetsov has been a marvel this entire playoff. He really has been. But they, you know, they still, and I thought Lars was very solid last night again, Lars Eller, but he's not Nick Backstrom.
Well, that's
Nick
leading.
Backstrom back. They yeah. need Nick Backstrom back.
That you're leading into my next question. Have they been waiting for to lose before putting him back in?
Maybe. I don't know, because I don't know just how badly that hand is damaged. I did the game when he got hurt. I said at the time that he was clearly hurt. I saw he's one of those guys that never shows any emotion over the course of a game, positive or negative. But you could tell when he came off, there was way too much emotion. He went right to the room after he came off the ice, and he was in agony. So something obviously bad happened with his hand. I don't know if it's broken. I don't know. Obviously something's wrong with his hand blocking a shot in the last series. But they need him back. And, again, some guys can do it through that. He needs his hands, because what's his greatest skill? His passing. And if you don't have your hand, I think that makes it pretty problematic.
How much does a coach's workload or tactics change from training camp when you're implementing a system and you want to make sure guys are in shape to practices during the regular season, the dog days, coming into the playoffs when you know you've got an off day, your games are every second day, you know you're seeing the same opponent four times in a week? What's different about how a coach handles playoffs versus a Thursday in January?
More times than not, people will make it optional in the playoffs, practices, either game day or even in between days. But where you really do your work is with mind work, whether it's individual meetings with tandems, matchup tandems, or meetings with lines, or meetings with special teams groups, or meetings with your goalies. I mean, that's where you kind of do your work, because it's less taxing on the body. It's a little bit more taxing on the mind, but less taxing on the body. So that's, I found over our two chases in Pittsburgh that was the best way to do it. The teams that I've watched over time since then, most of the ones that have been successful have done it that way as well. So it's a different form of preparation, there's no question. But what you do during the regular season, Rod, and this is something that always gets overlooked, but I think it's really important. You prepare your team in the regular season to learn how to make adjustments over the course of a playoff series. So let's say you're playing game 42 and it's Montreal versus Boston, and Boston's playing a heavy forecheck game, and you weren't expecting that for whatever reason that night. I'm just as a hypothetical. I'm just giving an example. You have to prepare your team of how to make that adjustment to playing against a heavy forecheck. So you teach them at that point. It's a teachable moment. Then you remind them, and they remember, and you go forward from there, and that allows you to make those adjustments in the playoffs.
Well, in many ways, the management team of a franchise, their work is done. It's almost a helpless, at times hopeless feeling. The coaching staff, the heavy lifting of their job is just starting.
That is absolutely right. And, you know, it's changed a lot since I did it. We used to do it with two VCRs and we'd tape them by hand. Do all
that's really heavy lifting.
Pardon me?
That's really heavy lifting, two VCRs.
It was in those days. It was, because you didn't have video coaches. You actually had to do it by yourself. So you would, you know, you'd make a power play tape, you'd make a penalty kill tape. If you were playing a straight matchup game, you'd show tendency of the other team's stars and what they would like to do, and then you'd prepare that for your matchup people. So there were lots of different things you would do. Now they just have it all on computers. It's so much easier for these guys. But it's still, you got to put the brain work in. Even though it's easier, you still got to put the brain work in.
So you won a couple of cups with Scotty in Pittsburgh. And I'm curious, when you see everybody, even the players sitting there between shifts, they now have access to the iPads, right? And they're looking at clips. I'm curious what you might have been able to do. Like, does that bring you back? Or do you think, geez, we managed to do a lot with nothing?
Well, I always think there's going to be progression. So this is obviously progress. Scotty was just such a fantastic teacher, and he knew how to teach complicated things in a very easy way. And I think that's one of the big arts of coaching, is taking a complicated situation and making it easy in a hurry. Problem solving, I guess, is the best way to describe it. These kids are different because they learn differently. You know, most children go to school now with an iPad. They're visual learners. They're not audio learners. So it's a little bit different. And I think this helps this generation. But I think we could have done a lot if we would have had access to video on the bench like they do today. I really do. Especially
quite an evening for the...
I'm sorry, Pierre. Go finish that thought.
No, I was just going to say, especially with our power play. Our power play was so darn good. I think it could have been even better.
Quite an evening for the Tampa Bay Lightning as they have won here in Washington 4-2. And so the lead in the series for the Capitals has been sliced in half.
Now, one of the talking points after the game was the Strawman hit on Tom Wilson. He was penalized for it. I know Barry Trotz didn't like it. Wilson himself didn't like it. Mitch?
I mean, you can tell me. I think if it's... I don't really know anymore. I don't know, but... I mean, if anyone wants to feel the goose egg on the side of my head, I mean, he leaves his feet. I'm in a pretty vulnerable spot, and he drives my head through the glass. You know, I'm not one to lay on the ice, but it took me a little bit to collect myself. I got back out there, but everything I've heard all year, he sees numbers for a good amount of time, and he elevates through the back of my shoulder and head. So,
you think NHL players think you should take a look at the head?
Well, it's their job to take a look at the hit for sure. I think they're probably reviewing it. I don't know how much goes into it. I can tell you if it's maybe the other way around, you better believe they're looking at it, and you better believe there might be a little bit more attention on it. So,
Pierre?
Everything he said is true. He's not embellishing anything. I mean, we called it right away. We said that was a penalty. Eddie said it.
The question is, should it be more than a penalty? I saw it as a boarding penalty.
Yeah, I don't think. I don't. I just saw a penalty.
Yeah.
I just saw a penalty. Again, everything gets magnified in the playoffs. But Tom was definitely in a vulnerable position. There's no question. I personally don't think that's a suspension. But if I were coaching the player, I'm telling you this straight up, I would tell the player, that's borderline, and you better be careful. So I'm not sure you want to do that again. That's what I would tell him. So I don't think that will be a suspension. I'd be surprised, but I'm in Tom Wilson's camp on this. It definitely was from behind, and it definitely left a mark. There's no question about that.
On the other hand, Anton Strålman does not have the rep that Tom Wilson has.
No, of course not. So Anton's just been such an efficient, smart, useful defensive player for such a long time. He's a very good teammate. Not that Tom Wilson isn't. Tom Wilson's a great teammate too, but he's nowhere near the same type player. Not even close.
The impact, though, Pierre, of Tom Wilson, because you know you see the big hits. I mean, he's been really good with Kuznetsov and Ovechkin, but there was the big hit on Tyler Johnson. I'm just wondering, the guys on the Tampa Bay Lightning, are they talking about Wilson when he's on the ice?
No, they're talking about him when he's on the bench, and they're yelling at him.
Here's Craig.
He's getting a lot of lip service from the Tampa bench, and he's giving it right back.
Craig Laughlin earlier today on Off the Cuff with Knuckles and Sean Campbell.
I'll give you my take on Tom Wilson. There's very few players like him in the NHL, maybe a handful at most, that play with that style. I don't want to change. I'm a big proponent of why do you want to change his style? He creates time and space and room for Ovechkin and Kuznetsov. I want Tom Wilson to stay the same because he's a holy terror on the ice, and I'm good with that. And if he walks the line, I'm okay with that too. And I'm sick and tired of the NHL trying to get rid of checking and body checking and open ice hits. That's part of the lore of the National Hockey League.
Pierre?
I don't think anybody's trying to get rid of hitting. I mean, I watch Ryan Callahan and Chris Kunitz and Cedric Paquette play. I don't think everything he said about Tom I agree with, by the way. But as far as the NHL trying to get rid of hitting, I respectfully disagree on that.
No, they're trying to get rid of hitting to the head.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to get rid of, hitting to the head. But in terms of open ice hits, they're not trying to get rid of anything. You know, I did a game the other night where Tyler Myers, who's 6'9", delivered a shot in the neutral zone. I forget who it was on, a Vegas player, and ripped his helmet off. And I made the point, Kenny said, yeah, his helmet came off. I said, yeah, Tyler Myers took it off. No, I don't think they're trying to get rid of hitting. But I said this, I know, on your show, and I'll say it again. If Tom Wilson was ever put on the trade market, there are 31 teams in the league. The one team that put him on, there'd be 30 people interested in buying him.
Yeah, no question.
The kids that come into the game now.
Go ahead, Pierre. Sorry.
Very, very good player.
The kids that come into the game now have become used to big stages, big performances, loud buildings at a younger age, so maybe it doesn't faze them, but that's the best I got.
All right, something that we've discussed a little bit here is Paul Maurice takes his Jets into Vegas tonight. Tampa now is 4-1 on the road in the playoffs. Rod has thrown the stat out about home teams being significantly under 500 now.
Well, I've been telling you this for 3 years. This has been my theory, and I'm sticking with it. The best 9-year-olds go to the Brick Tournament in Edmonton every summer. It's a big event. You know, I was fortunate enough to go watch my son play, and it's a huge, huge deal. If you look at the lineups of some of the teams, and then, you know, 7 to 10 years later, and you see where those players are playing in the World Junior or playing major junior hockey or about to be drafted in the NHL, you get an idea of what I'm talking about. So they learn as 9-year-olds what it's like to play in front of 6,000 people, because that's what they get at the Brick. Then they go to the Quebec Pee Wee Tournament, and if you're fortunate enough to play in the AAA side or play deep into the tournament, which I watched my son do, you're playing in front of 14 and 16,000 people, you know, in the old Colisée. And then, you know, so that's at a young age, big crowds and dealing with pressure. And then, you know, you get into the U16 national development situations or the U17 national development situations. Or if you're American, you go to the United States team development program. Or if you're Canadian, you're playing major junior hockey or maybe playing in the USHL. So kids are definitely getting more exposure at a younger age, and I don't think they're intimidated by crowd noise anymore. I really don't. I think it's a big part of it.
So what has to happen for this to change? I mean, we're always going to care about hockey. The crowds, I don't think, are going to diminish. Travel and amenities that the players have are only going to improve. I mean, are we going to get to a point where home ice becomes a huge advantage again?
No, I don't think we will, unless, I know you're going to probably say, no, don't do this. Every team has their own characteristic for a rink, whether it's the old, you know, Odd in Buffalo, which was very, very difficult to play in, or the old Garden in Boston, or, the Chicago Stadium. Some teams would be able to change the way the glass dimensions are. That's the only way I think home ice would matter. I really do. Because now everything's the same. It's all cookie cutter. It's 200 by 85. All the glass is the same height. In every rink in the league, everything's the same.
Pierre?
So it's
Pierre, I want you to tell our listeners who never had the opportunity to do so, the size of the visitor's dressing room at the Montreal Forum.
It was very small. In fact, you know those accordion doors? This is for the people that are at home listening. Picture this. You'd have a hard door, and then on the other side, there'd be an accordion door. So it wasn't even a real door, and you could feel people pushing into the door while they were smoking a cigarette in the hallway. So, yeah, it was really small.
The first time I went in there as a reporter in my early 20s after a game, I couldn't believe it. I was shocked how tiny it was.
Oh, yeah, no, it was really small. It was tough. But, again, the home ice advantage, you know, the form, the boards were really quick, especially the lower part of it. And it was built that way because the Canadians were always a very fast team. So it helped them. Then you could look at the Washington Building in Landover, Maryland. In the old days, you could ask Craig Locke and Lewis. They were the deadest boards in the league because they had a bigger team. They had a physical team, a robust team. So you put dead boards in, so you create more board play, and that's how you built your team to play well. And look at the Boston Bruins, the big, bad Bruins. Why was it? They had a small rink, and they could get to the net. They could body slam you. They could beat you up. So everybody in those days, you tailor-made your team to the type of rink you had. And I think if we ever got to that point again, that's when you would see home ice advantage really matter a ton.
What a trip it was watching an NHL game at the Boston Garden. What an experience.
What a trip it was to coach in that building. I'll tell you this quick story. Do you remember the upper deck? It almost leaned over the ice. Remember
right. The
upper deck?
Sure.
So one time I was talking to Bud Gavea. He was our trainer. And I said, Bud, like, I don't know if I got bitten by a bug, but there's something that's, like, itchy in my back. Can you take a look at it? He goes, yeah. There's a hot quarter down your shirt. It was somebody had heated up a quarter and dropped it down, and they found a way to get it down behind my shirt, between my neck and my shirt, and was stuck in my back. So, it was unbelievable, some of the stuff that used to happen.
A hot quarter? Like somebody takes their lighter and lights their quarter and then drops it into Pierre McGuire's shirt?
Oh, man.
Okay, let
me tell you one more.
All right.
One time we were playing in St. Louis, because, again, this shows you the difference. This was in the Checker Dome in the old building, which was legendary. I mean, it was a huge cement and steel building, gigantic. And they used to have two policemen on your bench because the glass was very low between you. In fact, I don't even know the first year I coached there if there was even glass behind the bench, so the police would be there. So we were playing in a game, and our team wasn't doing particularly well, so I was trying to slow things down, so I was flicking pennies on the ice. And the linesman comes over, and I think it was Ronnie Asselstein, and he says to the policeman, "What's going on here? Where's all the money coming from?" And the policeman doesn't say a word, but points at me, and he goes, "Pierre, stop it."
Wow. That was dangerous, yeah. Pierre.
No, it was during face-offs. It was during face-offs. It wasn't during play.
Oh, okay. I thought you were randomly throwing pennies on the ice.
Breakaway.
No.
All right. Let's before we finish up with the game tonight in Vegas, courtesy of Jimmy Murphy, murphyshockeylaw.net, with Jeremy Jacobs in Boston today.
Why do you think it just seems like Quebec keeps getting sort of pushed to the background or passed over?
Quebec is challenged, okay? I'm going to put it nicely. They're challenged. Look at the income base and the population base. And there probably isn't a smaller market, so they're going to really have to distinguish themselves in some other way, I would think. But you look at Houston and you look at them, you're fifth largest in North America versus, you know, the 105th, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so they have a different situation there. I mean, economically, they're challenged, and numerically, they're challenged. You know, they just don't have the numbers.
Do you think that is typical of the way most American owners feel?
I don't think just American. I think their Canadian owners feel the same way, too. They just don't have the chutzpah that Mr. Jacobs has and the power that Mr. Jacobs has to be able to say that publicly. But here's how, if I were counseling the people in Quebec, here's how I would try to distinguish myself. I'm using the word that Mr. Jacobs just used. Here's how I would try to distinguish myself from other people. I would say we're going to turn our team, much like Winnipeg, into an area team rather than a city team. So, yes, Quebec City is going to be where we play, but we are going to be, and we're going to try to have a schedule where our home games are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And maybe we play a Friday night and a Sunday afternoon, or maybe we play a Saturday afternoon and a Sunday night. But what we're going to be is we're going to be an area team, and we're going to be able to go into Northern Maine. We're going to be able to go into the Maritimes. We're going to be able to stay in Quebec City and the area around Quebec in the Gaspé Peninsula. But we're going to be an area team, and we're going to be a weekend team like Winnipeg. And we're going to be able to have great partnerships with our hotels, with our bars, with our taxi people, with our Uber people, and we're going to bring people in. And we're going to be a dynamic team. We're going to have an instantaneous rivalry with the Canadians. We're going to have a huge rivalry with Ottawa. We're going to have a big rivalry with Boston and a big rivalry with Toronto. But this is how we're going to do it. And I think if you could find a way to convince them of that, you could be successful there. Houston is going to get a team. I'm convinced of it. There's way too much chatter about Houston, way too much. And Seattle's going to get a team. Now, whether Houston gets an expansion team or a team moving there, that's another question. But that's a great job by Jimmy Murphy, by the way. That's big time. But they're gonna get a team.
Yeah, that's a
Houston,
clear window into what is being discussed at the highest level of the National Hockey League. Thank you to Jimmy Murphy. All right, Pierre, tonight, what do you look for? We're down to about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, again, really tough for Winnipeg to go in there and win. Tonight, there's a lot of momentum that Vegas built, and they now realize how they have to play if they're going to be successful. If you thought Vegas was quick in games one and two, they were quicker in two. They'll be the fastest in three of what you've seen so far. They just play a different style at home. They're much more quick in every facet of the game. So watch for that. Winnipeg's going to have to get a big performance from Connor Hellebuck. He's going to have to be really good early. Really, really good.
Thanks, as always, for the extra time today. And we will talk to you prior to game four tomorrow night.
Oh, thanks a lot, Mitch. And you know what? Again, congrats to Jimmy Murphy. That's an excellent soundbite. That is big time. That's really well done. Good for him.
It was your line that really, I thought, sent the physical tempo. You and Cedric Paquette and Chris Kunitz. Did you guys talk before the game about what you wanted to establish?
We don't have to. We've played together for quite a while now. We know what makes us successful, how we help the team, and that's getting pucks deep, taking the body, defending well. Early on, we had Ovi's line, so we knew we had a challenge, and we knew we were going to have to stop them if we wanted to win. And all playoffs, we've just been trying to work hard and create some momentum, and luckily enough, we did tonight.
Ryan, there were some people wondering about Andrei Vasilevskiy. Would he start this game three, or would you go with Louis Domingue? Tell us about the dressing room and the confidence you have in Andrei Vasilevskiy.
I mean, I don't know if they know hockey if they're questioning he's coming out of the net. I mean, you haven't watched him all year if that was the case. We didn't defend nearly good enough for him, and he made some big saves in game one and two. Just we gave him too many opportunities, too many great A's, and he's our backbone. He has been all year, and you see it again tonight.
Ryan, it's hard to sustain momentum from game to game in the playoffs. How do you plan on building off the momentum of game three?
Just play the same way. We saw we had success playing that way. We know they're going to come and make a huge push in game four, obviously, but we just worry about us, play the same way, and go from there.
Ryan Callahan with Pierre after the game last night on NBC. When we come back, following Mitch Gallo's update, Rich Griffin of the Toronto Star on Joey Votto.
Pierre McGuire, brought to you by Energy Transportation Group. Driven to be different. ShipEnergy.com.
Be honest.